There we go.
Good afternoon. I'm going to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Thursday, April 2nd. Good afternoon. So we are going to jump right in with the hearing on House Bill 3262. I'll open a hearing on House Bill 3262, and Wendy will give us a quick summary.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3262 requires that the Oregon Transparency website contain the biennial budget of each state agency for advertising purposes and annual expenditures by agencies for advertising purposes. There are no amendments before the committee and no revenue impact found for the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative. I know you've got a lot to do today, and so let me present just a couple of things that might be considered small housekeeping bills. I know you've heard that before, but let me try a few on you today, and let me begin with House Bill 3262. I'm in the advertising business, so I'm kind of alert to advertising issues, and I remember when we were running ads on the radio for Cover Oregon, I just heard one ad after another, and typically speaking, it would not concern me with respect to how many a client is running. There were a whole lot of commercials, and frankly, I kind of enjoyed it, and that was good for the coffers at that particular time. But I have heard advertising done before for various government agencies along the way. And so, you know, I got to thinking, well, let me take a look at the Oregon Transparency website and really see what we do advertising-wise. And I was a little bit surprised. It was, first of all, a little bit hard to understand. But when I took a look at the website relating to the various advertising costs, it wasn't really easily apparent as to what we were actually spending on advertising in a holistic sense. So I got to thinking, you know, it might be kind of interesting for us to have an opportunity to take a look at what kind of advertising is done, how much of it is done, perhaps how effective that advertising might be, and to actually see if there is more advertising than needs to be, considering the core function that it is advertising or addressing. And so really just kind of a simple thing, and that is to perhaps just have a mechanism here, and this appeared to be the easiest way, where we could get an easier and quicker understanding of the various advertising costs that are incurred by state government from time to time.
Question? Questions for Representative Wilson? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering, Rep. Wilson, if we were able to, you know, make radio advertising more functional for the state, would you be willing to have your voice do the voiceover for all of them?
You know, at this stage of my career, and Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, I'm kind of like Steven Tyler. I can't hit the high notes anymore, and I'm slowly losing what I have, so I have to conserve what I have. So I'd politely decline, but thank you for the offer.
Actual questions for Representative Wilson. Representative Nierman.
So thank you, Chair Fagan. Representative Wilson, how do you define advertising? So, like, for instance, I'm trying to think, is if I post something on the Department of State widgets Facebook page, is that advertising, or can you that doesn't cost anything but the salary paid for that, or do you have a definition of advertising?
Madam Chair, and to Representative Nierman, I tend to think of the advertising of, you know, the what I call really the big three, you know, radio and newspaper and television at this point in time.
Not billboards.
No.
And not, I mean, that is actually interesting, not online, because that is obviously a growing market for advertising with, you know, digital ads, social media ads. Would you not include those in the definition?
Madam Chair, we certainly could. I have to look at it from my own experience, and people can advertise on my website right now. And web advertising continues to, I consider that kind of the B team. Still in what we do. We have a tremendous amount of web traffic, but still, and as effective as it is slowly becoming for us, I continue to look at the mainstays in our business still of newspaper and radio and television. Sure.
Other questions for Representative Wilson? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3262? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3262 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3267. Wendy, do you want to give us a description?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3267 establishes a federal funds commission to study the nature and amounts of federal funds in the state budget, track availability and expenditure of state funds in the federal funds in the state budget, assess the risks and effects of reductions in or loss of federal funds, recommend contingency funding plans for federally funded state programs or services, and annually report to the Legislative Assembly, and there are no amendments to the bill before the committee.
All right. Thanks again, Madam Chair. For the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative Grants Pass. Wanted to bring this bill forward, and I want to tell you at the very beginning that establishing a new commission at the state level is not truly a goal of mine. But once again, looking from my own business experience, I realize that every day, and especially in an economy like we live in today, where I am really not sure from month to month what is going to happen, I make contingency plans and I update those on a very regular basis as to what I will do if I lose advertisers at a certain level. I have what I call really a scenario of a total destruction, and that is when I begin to lose everybody. That's something that I have to pay attention to. But yet, on a regular basis, I'm more likely to look at what is going to happen if I lose 15% of my advertisers, or 20%, on up to a near total loss. And so what I do on a regular basis is take a look at my own operation plan for my company and make plans on what I will do if I lose what I consider staple advertisers and stable advertisers. And so on a regular basis, I go through a review like that. Now, the intent here, as it applies to state government, is the fact that we all realize how much in federal funding we receive. And we receive a ton. But yet we know that federal funding can be capricious, and it can begin to disappear and could disappear overnight because we never know what's going to be happening in Washington, D.C. And so I'm really not aware of any plan that we have here at state level that looks ahead and makes a determination. What will we do if we lose this source of funding or that source of funding? And we ought to have some kind of plan. Now, by devising another commission, that's going to be expensive, and it is going to be probably deeper than we want to go in this. And it can be accomplished, I think, in easier ways. But the fact is, I'm really not aware of a plan that the state has that's going to deal with throwing out the ballast if we get in trouble. And I think we can all agree, you can't predict when trouble may come, especially from Washington, D.C. and the Congress. So the thought was, at least begin to put this in our collective minds, that we might begin to think about what could happen if you have a doomsday scenario and you really have to begin making some plans. Whether it would be smaller reductions in federal funding or the large, it would seem to me that we would just want to know what we're going to do, or at least have a plan. And with that, that kind of concludes what I have to say, but I'd be happy to answer questions, obviously.
Questions for Representative Wilson? Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wilson, I think this is a really key issue, and we're going to have a glimpse how important this is in next biennium as we see the federal allocation for health care be dialed back through the loss of the federal funds that former Governor Kitzhaber was able to negotiate, and then the natural ratcheting down of the Affordable Care Act distributions. That's going to put a hole in just the health care budget next biennium, anywhere from $600 million to $1 billion. So I think it is certainly prudent to start looking and discussing these issues.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Buehler, I have heard that story, and I do understand that that is on the horizon. And as we all know, something else can suddenly appear on the horizon as well. It can put us in a real difficult spot. So at least we need to think about it. This is probably not the mechanism to do it, but at least I think we need to be thinking about it in a way that is less expensive than forming a commission.
Representative McLean. Did you? I'm sorry. Okay. Can I say
The only question that I had is that you're saying this isn't the mechanism to do it. You brought the bill forward, and I was curious, did you have a fiscal impact? Or I mean, there's nothing on OLIS, but had you actually asked for estimates on that? Because I know it's...
Madam Chair and Representative Rayfield, no, I did not do that.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I think it's a good idea that we think about these things. I'm kind of curious, though, about the mechanism. It seems that we do have, you know, our emergency board and the Ways and Means process and the fiscal office that all monitor the funds that we have available to us, and the revenue office as well, that monitor those funds pretty continuously throughout the year. And, you know, as well as the governor's office, I believe. And so I think those conversations actually do happen. And, you know, there are folks in this building that are, you know, having those conversations as they project, you know, potential changes. And, you know, how we react to that, of course, is, you know, based on the available funds to us at the time. And we have to, you know, since we have to balance our budget, unlike the federal government, we are forced to react to that. But I don't know. I sort of think we already have this process. And short of, you know, somehow having a huge savings account in place to mitigate potential impacts that we see coming, I'm just not sure what this potential commission or other body would be able to do that we aren't already doing. So I don't know. Have you comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I'm comforted by that. You know, it's been a long time since I've been around here. It's been a dozen years since I served, and I'm not exactly sure how well or who talks to who. And I guess that's one thing that we've noticed from 9/11 on. We are sometimes shocked and amazed at the lack of communication between agencies of the government. And so, anyway, as I say, I'm comforted to hear that, and I'm trusting that they will do that. Would just be good if we actually did know that.
Good point.
Yeah. Anyone else? Okay. Yes.
Representative Wilson, in your description of the qualifications for membership on this committee, just says something like they have a no. I'm trying to get to it. Are well informed on the principles of state finance there. I see sometimes the makeup of a commission is says two of them have to be the member of the governor's party and two of them not or whatever. Sometimes there's like a partisan breakup or some other kinds of qualifications. Was that oversight or do you not fear that there's going to be any kind of partisan issues or was that your intention?
Madam Chair and Representative Nierman, a lot of times when I look at putting together things like this, I try to approach it from a nonpartisan standpoint and just say, here it is. Let's examine it as one body and let's just talk about it. You know, not necessarily do we have to have an odd number of folks on a committee to make impact. And perhaps that's naive, but like I say, I've put three terms in here before, and I know all things tend to be political, but sometimes it's better to approach it, I think, from a softer way and just see where the chips fall when reasonable people talk.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3267 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3273. Wendy?
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 3273 opposes a one-year moratorium on adoption, amendment, or repeal of any administrative rule that has fiscal impact on the public of $50,000 or more. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
And thank the committee again. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this forward. Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative. The issue really is administrative rules. Frankly, I have a bill that I like better, and it's H.J.R. 28. It's a proposal to amend the Constitution relating to legislative review of administrative rules. As we all know, it is our job as legislators to make the laws, and many times we make those laws and we send them off to agencies after they pass, and we send away a thoroughbred racehorse, and sometimes it comes back as a giraffe. And we've all had experience with that over time. And so really the point that I'm talking about today, number one, we do have, at least I hear in my district all the time, and I'm not sure what you hear in your district, but I hear people complaining on a regular basis of administrative rules and the fact that what they want to do is many times thwarted by rule and not by statute. I can understand that frustration. This is our system, and this is the way it works. But however, the and I can look back a few years ago and look at some of the bills that I passed, and they wound up the nature of the bills being changed by the administrative rules that came along. In my particular district, we suffer a lot of financial hardship, and we are looking everywhere we possibly can for good things to happen, to allow entrepreneurs to be just that, and to allow people to live out their economic dreams. But I hear, and I would imagine you hear as well, people being thwarted by endless rules and regulations that really we didn't have a part in doing. And they call me and say, hey, what's going on here? And I say, well, we did our best to pass reasonable law and good law here, but no, you're right, we didn't really intend that particular thing to happen. So I would just appreciate, no matter what happens with this, I would just appreciate us to begin to think more about the administrative rule process. And it is not a partisan issue, because I think we're all frustrated by those things that can happen. So I would just trust that we would begin to build an awareness of the possibility out there through whatever mechanism that we begin as a legislature to have a greater control and a greater review on administrative rules, and really allow those who really desire to grow and prosper in their communities, and especially our rural communities, because we're very sensitive about that, to really let them be able to run. And I don't mean willy-nilly, but just with reasonable rules set forth on those bills that we pass. So,
yes.
Madam Chair, this one was really interesting to me, and what your goal is from what you just said then, Representative, was that you want to have a conversation about rules and how rules are made and when you make rules. And so I really support that conversation, because I heard in another committee on rule, where we were dealing with some issues on making rules, where they were saying that there was a rule being made like every 15 minutes. And so that sounds like an awful lot of rules for the public to have to digest and or use. And so I really appreciate your motives here. But the question I have is, why pick the number of $50,000? And if you just want a conversation about rules, is this the best way to have it?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative McLean, I'm not sure this is the best way to have it. But once again, to me, it was a door opener here. I picked the $50,000 really to coordinate with what we often consider fiscal impact. Mm-hmm. And when something costs over $50,000, we pay very close attention, or that, I think, is a trigger sometimes to a fiscal impact statement. And so I just sort of picked that out because it corresponds to that. Yes.
Yes.
I noted in a list there was a testimony from the Department of Revenue that said basically every administrative rule that they make as far as relating to taxes actually is above $50,000.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at some exemption to that, would you be open to something like that?
Madam Chair and Representative Rayfield, yeah, I certainly would be willing to talk about such a thing, indeed.
Right. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. This is about to demonstrate that I am new here, but when I read the way it's written as far as fiscal impact, is that both positive or negative? I mean, I would hate to see if there's an administrative rule that is just good wisdom that they discover that they can save $50,000. I would hate to have that put on hold for a year, but that just might be my lack of understanding on this fiscal impact.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Stark, I understand your point there, and I see that as a weakness of the way this is written. Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Wilson, one other thing, and I'll like my friend Representative Stark, I'll play the new guy card here. When I see fiscal impact, to me that says government spending. And what, and then the opposite side of that coin is revenue impact. And so I'm almost thinking, does fiscal impact in this bill just mean spending, or does it mean spending and revenue generating on that? And so I want to kind of, I'm supportive of the concept, but I want to make sure that that gets included in there.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Nierman, I agree with what you're observing there. I understand.
Okay. Other comments or questions? All right. Thank you, Representative.
Thanks for the time today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3273? Okay, seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3273. And I think I see a few folks here who are here just for our work session, so I'm going to go ahead and do those work sessions quickly right now. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2250. And do you want to give us a quick reminder?
Chair and members, House Bill 2250 authorizes the Department of Administrative Services, or DAS, to adopt rules relating to electronic fingerprint capture. The bill directs DAS to adopt rules establishing factors to be considered when making fitness determinations and appealing fitness determinations. It applies laws requiring the use of uniform rules regarding making fitness determinations to state agencies and entities currently exempt from such rules. Becomes operative January 1st, 2016. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage, and the Legislative Fiscal Office has requested that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee after our committee.
So we're sending.
So, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the House Bill 2250-5 amendment dated March 31st, 2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 2250. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Okay, seeing none, so adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2250 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Grab that one. Representative Rayfield has moved that House Bill 2250 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative
Clark?
Yes.
Representative
Holby? Excused.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Newman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wheeler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right. And I think probably Representative Nathanson probably wants to carry this bill, so we'll assign her as the carrier. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2250 and open a work session on House Bill 2845. And do you want to give us a reminder of what that is?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2845 establishes conditions under which a person may sell guaranteed asset protection waivers in connection with the sale or lease of motor vehicles. It specifies the conditions under which the purchaser may cancel or the creditor may terminate a gap waiver, requires the person who sells the gap waiver in connection with the retail sale of motor vehicle to insure the gap waiver with reimbursement insurance policies, provides condition for reimbursement insurance. And there is no subsequent referral on this bill.
And Madam Chair, I would move to adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 2845, dated March 25th, 2015.
Representative Rayfield has moved to adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 2845, dated 3/25/15. Is there any discussion?
And then, as I was going through the amendments, I thought it might make sense to have Mr. Miller come forward and actually, you know, walk through just a little bit some of the changes, because there were, you know, it seems to be an entire change. I thought that would be helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Guaranteed Asset Protection Alliance. Product we're discussing is the GAP waiver. These are companies, again, just a quick reminder, that are the finance companies such as Ford Motor Credit. And the debt at the first hearing, we had a dash 4, which is a gut and stuff of the bill. And so we went through the provisions of the dash 4 since that first hearing. There was just a few technical changes that the Attorney General's office had asked us to make, but then one substantial, and I'm willing to go through that and ask any questions. But if you look at the dash 5 on page 9, section 8 deals with the provisions of enforcement, and so ORS 646607 is what we had in the dash 4, which is part of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, which is more of a regulatory function within the Attorney General's office. 646608, which we changed it to, and so the dash 5, I think that's the one substantive change between the dash 4 and dash 5, is the Attorney General enforcement plus the private right of action. And so, you know, banks, auto dealers are currently under that particular scenario, 608. And also, this avoids any fiscal impact. And so, you know, again, we're regulated by the Attorney General's office now, or at least the auto dealer would be under this circumstance anyway. And so we're fine with the change. And so, I'm happy to walk through the sections, but that was the one, I think, substantive change that came from the first hearing. And since then, and I know they're in the audience, they were fine with that change.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sean. Any further discussion? Okay. And is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, so adopted.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2845 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 2845 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative
McClain?
Aye. Representative
Nierman? Aye. Representative Starr?
Yes.
Representative Hagan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beeler?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Beeler?
Yes. Okay, and with that, go ahead.
I will, yeah. I think it has to be a motion, though, suspend the rules.
Yeah. With that, is there anyone in particular who would like to carry this bill?
I will.
Okay, go ahead. So Representative Nierman will carry that. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2845. And you can move to suspend the rules so that we hold it can vote on 2250.
Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Holvey to vote on the bill that he was conspicuously absent on.
Yeah.
I didn't notice.
Representative Rayfield has moved to suspend the rules to allow Representative Holvey to vote on House Bill 2250. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Rayfield. I appreciate that. since I worked many sessions on helping get this bill to this point, I vote aye.
All right. Representative Holby votes aye. And I don't need to close the work session, right, because I didn't.
The rules, no.
Okay.
The rules were suspended.
Okay, great. Thank you for that indulgence. I just knew that there was a lot of people here that were just here for work sessions, so I thought we would put them out of their misery. And with that, let's see. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2987.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2987 removes requirement for a contracting agency to reserve monies for including green energy technology in constructing, reconstructing, or renovating a public building if the contracting agency determines that including green energy technology is not appropriate. It requires a contracting agency to report to the Department of Energy the amount that would have been spent on green energy technology had the contracting agency determined that including green energy technology was appropriate. It requires the Department of Energy to report to the Legislative Assembly on contracting agency compliance with reporting mandates, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage and becomes operative January 1st, 2016.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. House Bill 2987 is technically a cleanup bill to some degree, but there is an issue that the provision that's being removed from this bill was put in for, and so that remains a little bit of a concern. But the reality is it's troublesome for local governments, contracting agencies, to take money as required by law to set it aside when this money's been bonded for the purpose of construction. One of the requirements of construction is that they consider 1.5% for green technology. When it's appropriate, they put it in. When it's not appropriate, they don't. And when they use state funds, they're supposed to track that amount and roll it up into a future proposal for a project. And so it's that accounting for of those dollars that's supposed to be reported on a form to the Department of Energy so they can keep track of the required investment going forward. So it was a frustration that we heard from the Department of Energy and for some contracting agencies that didn't fill out this report, so there was no accountability in tracking these dollars into the future when they should be used. And so the idea of the piece that went in there to make them physically hold those dollars in an account came about as trying to have that accountability, but it really does not, it's not consistent with good policy of managing funds, especially bonded funds that are supposed to be utilized for construction on any given project. And so I think it's prudent for us to remove that requirement out. It does leave a little bit of a vacuum for how you hold contracting agencies for turning in the required form to the Department of Energy so that they can track and make sure that this program is being adhered to. And so it's a difficult piece, so that maybe there's potentially an amendment for it that we'll figure out in the next day or two for this bill to come up with a mechanism for that accountability. But at the very least, I think that this bill does need to remove this requirement on local governments and other contracting agencies to actually hold these funds in an account. I don't think it's appropriate. So this is a little bit of a complex program, more complex than it really should be, but this piece, I think, needs to be fixed. So thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for our colleague? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Holvey, this bill isn't what I thought it was when I first read it. So I don't understand, what's the current requirement? So if I'm a contractor and I'm going to do a state project, then I have to have 1.5% of the funds set aside. What for what purpose? I can't figure out what purpose here. I have to spend 1.5% on green energy?
So you're talking about the underlying program,
right, yeah,
that is not a requirement on the contractor. It's a requirement for the local government when they use state funds to plan their projects to utilize 1.5% of the contract amount for green technology in their building, and you know, for new buildings and buildings that are majorly remodeled. So that's the project, the program. And so, but we leave the ability for the local government to say, hey, this building's in the shade, or it doesn't work, or we find it not to be appropriate on this building, and that's fine. And they can say, we're not going to do it this time. But if there's state funds in it, they need to be able to say, okay, we will take an equal amount of this 1.5% that would have been used on this project and roll it up into a future investment of a upcoming project in the future. It's meant to help bring our buildings into a more energy efficient arena and potentially save taxpayers money with a more efficient technologies.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so I think I did read it correctly then. So I mean, it's to prevent, so we're not making, we're not putting green energy dollars into a gravel shed that ODOT's building or something like that.
Correct. There's several exemptions for what kind of projects this applies to. It doesn't apply to projects that aren't occupied to a certain level. I don't remember exactly what that is. I think that's determined by rule. I know the Department of Energy is in the room. If you have more specific questions about the program, this bill isn't really about the program in, you know, overall scope. This is trying to fix a little piece that requires them to set aside money in an account that should be being used for the construction of the project instead of setting it aside and waiting for some future project to come along. What we really need is that accounting and the form that provides that accounting turned into the Department of Energy. And so that's, you know, the mechanism, but the mechanism of actually holding the money in a physically in an account, you know, and requiring local governments or any contracting agency, state agency, to do that is really not consistent with, you know, what our purpose of bonding to build a project and using that money for construction. It's not bonding it to put set it aside in a savings account for some future project. So the accounting is what the goal is here, not physically holding the money. So that's what this is trying to fix.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions? Go ahead.
Can I ask one more? I'm sorry. I'm just not getting this here. So the agency makes the determination as to whether or not the project is appropriate for to have the 1.5% set aside then. So if I'm ODOT.
That's correct.
So if I'm ODOT and I'm building a gravel shed in La Grande, I'm going to say, no, this doesn't count, and I'm not going to set aside any money for any green energy thing because it's just a stupid gravel shed out in the middle of on some highway.
Yeah, gravel sheds are exempt from this
program. Okay, so that example doesn't work. But
for purposes of legislative history.
some kind of... I'm playing the new guy card a lot today, I see. But but it's the contracting agency that's going to make that determination. So is there any potential for abuse? So I say, well, I'm ODOT, and we're building our new facility on Fairview Industrial Drive, and I've determined that this isn't really a thing where green energy is appropriate, and so we're not going to set aside that 1.5%. Is there a possibility for that abuse in this? Or
well, there is if the contracting agency doesn't follow the law and account for that 1.5% that they didn't use. The program requires them to account for that 1.5% amount and report it to the Department of Energy. That's what the law says. The problem is there's not a great way to compel government to follow the law. And so, you know, that's one of the problems with some of the statutes around this. And so that's what one of the discussions that I've spoke to, that we might be looking at an amendment that does provide some compelling action that would get the contracting agencies to actually fill out the form, document the amount that they did or did not spend on green technology, because that information is extremely important to the Department of Energy. And so, you know, we're working on some way to compel government to follow the law and send that form in.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair.
I won't let him have any more, I promise.
I get the feeling I'm going to be 100% behind this when I'm done, but I just feel like I'm not understanding it. So
it's worth bearing with him.
Yeah. But so, we have time. You know, I could talk to you some other time.
I should probably do that. Why don't I just do that?
Thank you. I won't ask for other questions. Thank you, Representative.
And certainly the Department of Energy, you know, you can ask them questions about this program as well. So.
Actually, can I just
ask one?
Sure.
Oh, she said no.
Sorry.
But we do have three other people to testify on it.
This is an easy one. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holby, do you know of other similar allocations for other requirements of public buildings other than this?
Similar allocations?
Yeah, that you have to set aside a certain percentage to...
Well, I think there on some public buildings, for example, there is a requirement to set aside money for the inclusion of art in public buildings as well. So I guess my answer would be yes.
Do we have a similar problem with something like that?
I don't know. I haven't really tracked that program. I don't know that that particular program has the ability for the contracting agency to say, no, we don't think art's appropriate.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if that means they have to put art in the gravel shed or not. I don't really know that program quite as well. I think it pertains to buildings like this one does.
Yeah, just a comment. So actually, it creates an interesting problem. I saw this at Oregon State. They put up a big new chemistry building, which is very expensive, not much wall space. And 1% has to go to art. So when you go in this new chemistry building, the lobby looks like a museum because 1% of the total cost of this chemistry building with all the HVAC, you have to have incredibly elaborate artwork in this chemistry building. So there may be an opportunity here to I'm all for supporting the arts, but when you have $1 million pieces of sculpture in a college chemistry building, it seems a little over the top, especially for a state that's having a hard time, funding its schools
If you want to address that particular issue, I don't think this is the correct vehicle, and it wouldn't probably fit within the relating to clause.
Yeah, something to think about.
Is there a bill out there that says relating to anti-art?
I don't think that's a
that representative.
Relating to $1 million sculptures.
I'm just against $1 million sculptures in chemistry building.
Well, cool. I think the percentages are they're small sometimes enough to where a 1.5% in this case may not be enough to make a substantial investment that an agency may just say, we're gonna take that 1.5% and roll it into another project where we can really do a much larger investment and get credit for it. So, I think it's all all economies of scale.
Right, or 1% in a chemistry building.
Right, but I don't want to talk about art.
Yes,
exactly. He's a carpenter.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. All right, next I'll have Mark Landauer, Tracy Rutten, and Brian Craig. Although I didn't see Brian in here, I don't think. Oh, there he is. Oh, sorry, your head was down. All right, there he is.
Put him to sleep.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of this bill, and I thank Representative Holvey for bringing the bill forward. This was an issue that came to our attention following passage of a previous bill dealing with this 1.5% program. And I think the running joke now is it wouldn't be a legislative session if we didn't talk about the 1.5% Green Energy Technology Program, because I'm pretty sure since its inception, correct me if I'm wrong, Representative, it has been back every single session. So. As we began the process of rulemaking following the passage of a bill that I think was maybe in 2013, could have been 2012, we were debating in the hall when that was, it came to our attention that there was a requirement to hold the funds in a separate bank account. And we were not really aware, I think, upon passage of the bill that that was a requirement and component of the new statute. And that was when it came to our attention as well at that time from our finance officers and some of those who deal in government accounting standards, that is really not ideal in terms of how they deal with their public funds, and that there's a difference between holding funds over for accounting purposes and physically holding funds in a separate bank account. And especially if you're not going to have a project for maybe another 10 years or so, to see those funds just sitting there in that manner that were originally bonded for a certain type of project is, for them, obviously less than ideal. So we would support the bill. And I do want to correct maybe one thing for the record, and kind of goes to, I think, some of the complication of this program. And the rulemaking is really something. If you want to look through the rules of the program, it's enough to make your head spin. But the way the program works is that you set aside the 1.5% of your total contract price. That's regardless of whether state funds are used. Upon determining whether it's appropriate or not appropriate to use the funds for solar or geothermal or whatever the requirement would require for those funds, you carry forward the funds, but only if state funds were used. So the carry forward provision only applies to when state funds were part of the original project. So it's kind of interesting in that mechanism. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record, that regardless of whether state funds are used, we are required to do the 1.5% unless it's deemed to be not appropriate. And in terms of whether something is appropriate, the rules do address those things. Things like historic buildings, for instance, might not be appropriate in certain situations. If the solar doesn't generate a certain total solar fraction, a new terminology that I became familiar with, but over 70% is the threshold for that, then that would not be an appropriate project for this. So, and the final thing I just wanted to say is, in terms of energy efficiency in our local governments, they are, I would say, very many of them very enthusiastic about the projects that they undertake. We recently had the opportunity to tour the city of Gresham's wastewater treatment plant, and I will gladly extend an invitation to all of you to tour that plant. I know it's wastewater treatment, but it is a very cool project. For that project, they have actually gone from about a $500,000 a year energy bill to $2,000 a year, and that is really merely for their connection to the grid that they have to continue in case their own energy generation for some reason does not pan out or fails to produce the energy. But the way that they've done that is through collecting fat, soils, and grease in their community, putting it in their anaerobic digester, and they produce enough energy to generate for a lot of the plant with about 9% then from solar. Wastewater treatment plants are not a part of this requirement, but I just wanted to bring that project and that example forward because our folks really are interested in these projects when they make sense. The reason they do it is because it saves a lot of energy and it saves their ratepayers a lot of money as well, and it's good for the environment. So we are committed to these types of projects, and I just want to thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions that you have.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. I'm Mark Landauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We have approximately 950 districts throughout the state, and I'd just like to make a few comments and associate myself with Ms. Rutten's remarks. At the outset, just like you to know, keep clear of the halls because a herd of lobbyists stampeded down the hallway trying to dig up some million-dollar sculptors for clients. With that being said, I'd like to just clarify a couple of other things for the record. Representative Nierman wanted to understand what these particular requirements apply to. And if you look at, I believe it's page one of the bill, lines 20 and 21, you'll note what these requirements apply to. They apply to buildings occupied by employees of the public body or that are used in the conduct of public business. So your gravel shed arguably is not for the conduct of public business, certainly is a part of that. With the other point I just wanted to quickly make, representing 950 districts, many of them very, very small and rurally located, we have worked very hard over the last year and a half with the Department of Energy to ensure that our clients, our members, are aware of this requirement. Having 950 separate government entities, it can be challenging, and we do place this requirement in our newsletter and did so last year to ensure that everybody was aware of it. Now, you can mail things to folks. It doesn't mean they're going to read it. And we continue to try to educate our members in this requirement to ensure that they're compliant with the law. But I'll be frank with you, that is a challenge, but we continue to work with the Department of Energy to ensure that our members are aware of this requirement, and we will continue to do so, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you like. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, Brian Krieg, speaking for IBEW 48 today. IBEW 48 has been a big supporter of this program all through the various iterations of it each year as we go through that. There's been a lot of great products, projects that have been done out there. We're also supportive of the need to make some accounting adjustments in the technical process on here so that the local governments can move forward and do things efficiently. But as Representative Holvey noted in his testimony, we do have just a small concern about the rolling up of funds over time and making sure that we actually get around to using them because, looking at it from our workforce standpoint, these are jobs and we're supposed to be moving along with them at some point in time. So I am more than happy to work with the representative and Ms. Rutten and my good friend Mark here. You'd note they did surround me to beat me up if I say anything wrong here on this over the next few weeks on this. That's our only minor concern on here. It's a great program.
Questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2987? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2987 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2664. Wendy, do you want to give us the description? And Ryan, you can go ahead and come up with whoever you want to bring.
Madam Chair and members, House Bill 2664 subjects a university with a governing board or not-for-profit organization or other entity controlled by a university with a governing board to certain prevailing wage provisions of the Public Contracting Code. It applies prevailing wage provisions of the Public Contracting Code to agreements for the private entity to construct, reconstruct, renovate, or paint an improvement on real property owned by a university with a governing board or not-for-profit that it controls. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage.
Good.
And there is a dash one amendment as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bolus. I represent the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. And Madam Chair, since there's some members on the committee that weren't here in 2013 when the original bill was passed, with your permission, I'd like to give just a very brief explanation of the history of prevailing wage laws, why we believe they're good public policy for Oregon, and how this bill that you're looking at today came to you. The original Prevailing Wage Act was passed on the federal level in the 1930s during the Great Depression. It was sponsored by two members of the Federal House of Representatives, Representatives Davis and Bacon. And so the federal prevailing wage laws is often commonly referred to as the Davis-Bacon Act. And the intent of that law was, as the federal government was spending huge amounts of tax dollars to fund construction projects and put people back to work around the country, was that those dollars, as they're spent in the various locations, be used to employ local workers and local contractors. So, for instance, when the federal government was funding Timberline Lodge, obviously the intent was for Oregon contractors and Oregon workers to be employed on that project and not have contractors and workers possibly coming in from out of state and winning the projects basically based on how little they could pay their workers. Oregon's prevailing wage law was passed in 1958. It was signed by Governor Mark Hatfield. And again, the intent was the same. When Oregon tax dollars are being spent to fund construction projects in the state, hopefully those projects are going to be built by Oregon contractors and Oregon construction workers and Oregon laborers. Every year, the Bureau of Labor and Industries contracts with the Employment Department and does a construction industry wage survey, and they survey all contractors that do commercial and heavy highway construction work. And the state is broken down into 14 regions, and then wage rates for all crafts are published in each region. So the rate for a bricklayer in Portland might be different than a bricklayer in Lakeview. And so that's an attempt to try and get a reflection of the market rates and, again, to incent the use of local workers and local contractors. In 2013, we entered into discussions with the Oregon University System. At the time, there was talk about some of those entities leaving the Oregon University System. Public-private partnerships were coming on board as a potential alternative method of contracting. And so we listened to OUS and their viewpoints, and we came up with a bill that basically said if a project is built on university-owned land, then prevailing wage would apply. And we and they both put a lot of time into it. We reached a consensus bill. It received broad bipartisan support, and it passed the Senate 27-2 and passed out of the House 49-10. When we took a look at the bill as it was passed, and I think it was just due to some drafting language where things just didn't quite match up as they had intended, there was just some places that we feel that the intent of the bill wasn't properly captured. And so we introduced House Bill 2664. We worked with representatives of the Oregon University System again. They had some concerns about one part of the bill and offered up and asked us to do an amendment, which we did. That's the Dash 1 amendment that's before you. And with that, we feel that once again we've reached a consensus bill. There's no opposition that we know of. And so we would respectfully ask you to support House Bill 2664 with the Dash 1 amendment, and we hope that once again we receive broad bipartisan support. And that's the end of my remarks, Madam Chair, and if there's any questions, I would do my very best to answer them.
Thank you.
All right. For the record, my name is Ryan Trivett, here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors. We are in support of this legislation. We were a part of the process last session, and to maybe just add a little bit more specificity to sort of what the issue was, when we passed House Bill 2646, the Independent Governing Board bill had not yet passed, so it was impossible for Ledge Council to reference public universities with governing boards at that time, and they had to write based on what the existing statute was, which was universities within the Oregon University System. We had received assurances at the time that that the changes in 2646 would flow through the Senate Bill 270 at the time, and we only found out after session got out that that had not actually happened, that a conflict amendment was needed, and so so that's just sort of a little bit more of the specificity as to why this bill, it was needed to fix that. And National Electrical Contractors Association represents over 300 small businesses in Oregon. And so when he described, Mr. Mullis described the utilizing taxpayer dollars, Oregon taxpayer dollars, employing Oregon contractors, we can tell you the economic ripple effect through the economy is quite significant of the public works dollars. And so we think the prevailing wage law is very important to maintain. So those are my remarks.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm here representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Building on what Mr. Trivett has just said, this bill does provide some clarity to what could be a little bit of murky language. All of us are working off of a handshake now, understanding what was meant. 5 years down the line, players will change, and someone may make an error in interpreting the language down the line, and that could be, you know, a bit of a problem for all of us involved on it. So this bill does put it into clarity of what we had all agreed upon, and so we urge you to support the bill and pass it on. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, this would not have jurisdiction over a non-public university that was not-for-profit?
Yeah. Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, that's correct.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who are the parties to this agreement of the previous bill? So I get it that it's the contractors and labor and things, but who's the other parties to the bill? Was it the university system or?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, yes, we met with representatives of the Oregon University System, Hans Bernard and Debbie Doris Koreski. Mr. Bernard was here earlier. He had to leave, and I think he left information with the chair that they are supportive of the bill.
Okay. I was wondering that. So are there meeting materials? Is there in OLIS or?
No, he actually is signed up to testify, but the university president is in the building today, so he was going to have to run multiple meetings. He just gave me his card and said that I could say for the record that the University of Oregon is supportive, and he also said, I can say for the record from the University of Oregon, go Beavs. He actually said that I could say that.
Wow. That was Hans that said that.
One. Really good politician.
He said Hans to say that yesterday.
No.
Okay, that's helpful because I was wondering where the other side was on this. So I wanted to hear that. So actually, that's helpful. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the only other person I see signed up is Hans Bernard, but he is not here. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2664? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2664, and we're going to carry over Senate Bill 3. I know. Okay, we'll stay on these for a moment. So I got a request. We had an email request from. Okay. Number error mix up in my head. So now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 358.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 358 changes the requirement that agencies file adopted rules with the Legislative Council from 10 days after filing with the Secretary of State to within 10 days of filing, removes the requirement that modification of agency rules that change the name of agency, name of the program, correct spelling or grammatical mistakes, correct statutory references or addresses or telephone numbers be filed with and undergo review by Legislative Council. And there is a dash one amendment that I believe has been posted on OLIS.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, I'm Belissa Seidlick with Legislative Council's office. And this will be very brief. I am speaking to the introduced version of the bill. It basically makes two fixes to Legislative Council's review of administrative rules that we've run into. The first one deals with what we call the 10-day rule. There's a statute that provides that agencies must submit to our office copies of their rules within 10 days, and the operative word here is after copies are filed with the Secretary of State. And there's another statute that provides unless these copies are submitted in this manner, the rule is invalid. Now, what often happens because of the mail and state delivery system is that we will receive these copies a day or two before the Secretary of State does, and in accordance with that other statute, those rules are automatically invalid. This creates a big problem for state agencies who then have to reissue whatever rule it was that has become invalid. Senate Bill 358 would fix this by providing that copies of the rules may be filed with our office within 10 days of the date of filing with the Secretary of State. So it can either be 10 days before or 10 days after, and that should take care of the problem. The second issue that the bill is designed to fix deals with non-substantive amendments. By statute, agencies do not have to go through the notice, public comment, and hearing procedures for certain listed non-substantive changes that were named by Ms. Simmons in her reading of the introduction. For example, the name of the agency when it's been updated references to statutes, grammatical and spelling errors. And while there's a statute that exempts agencies from the notice and hearing and public comment processes, it doesn't exempt them from filing copies with our office, nor does it exempt our office from reviewing these non-substantive changes. And often these are housekeeping changes, and just reams of paper will come into our office. So what Senate Bill 358 does is it adds to this statute that agencies do not need to file copies of non-substantive amendments as listed in the statute, and our office does not need to review them. And that is all that the introduced version of the bill does.
I just have a quick question.
Representative Rayfield?
So if does there anybody who checks to make sure that something is substantive or procedural? So that kind of, and I don't know if that is your role in reviewing these or if the Secretary of State's office is in charge of where, you know, and I'm an attorney, and so sometimes we disagree on what is substantive and what is procedural, and so I'm curious if who actually looks at that.
Right. Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, the listed non-substantive elements that may be addressed in this statute are so straightforward that there's hardly anything to review. It's like the name of an agency or a spelling error or a grammatical error, a change in a web address. So there really is not much leeway to turn that into something substantive.
And just a follow-up. Something grammatical could be substantive, though. And also someone could, you know, slip something in inadvertently or intentionally and having a, you know, a review on that. Is there anybody that does that?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, I would presume that the persons in the agency responsible for adopting the rule and reviewing the rule and signing off on the rule would check that. And these non-substantive changes are usually submitted all at once with nothing substantive. So it's not as though they're going to be buried and missed.
And so what I'm asking is, there is somebody reviewing the agency's determination that this is substantive or procedural?
Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, not outside of the agency that I know about.
And then the last follow-up is, and currently, when those bills get to your office, do you review them for substantive or procedural changes, or just double-check?
Representative Fagan, Chair Fagan, Representative Rayfield, currently our office is required to review them, yes.
Okay. Thank you. I apologize for hassling you there.
Other questions, or Representative McLean?
Well, mine was really similar to that. It just seems with such a big organization and with so many agencies and with so many rules made that it's really important to understand the review process. And so it's important to me, especially when you hear about folks dealing with rules and trying to understand if it's a policy decision or it's a rule to carry out the policy decision, that there has to be a process. And so if we were to support this, it's a very apparent that we're simply saying that that list is enough of a safeguard, or it's enough of a, you know, of a check that we are comfortable that everything else that comes to you will be reviewed.
Chair Fagan and Representative McLean, everything else would be reviewed by us, yes. Now, we are, by statute, our office, Legislative Council, is only charged with reviewing a rule to make sure that it complies with the intent and scope of the enabling legislation and to make sure it doesn't raise any constitutional issues. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there is no statutory obligation that our office has to take a look at other things like, does the rule work or what is the fiscal
right.
effect?
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Other guest, Representative Holby.
Just curious if somebody's going to address the Dash 1 amendment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't
seen. Thank you.
Is that your amendment?
That's my amendment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to do it from here or down there?
Whatever's most
easy. You might as well do it down there. That way it's kind of easier.
That way we can sit on
and be,
I like that.
And Representative Bueller, please be quick, because there's a room full of people that want to testify on this bill.
I can see it's generated a tremendous amount of interest.
It's the first time I've ever looked from the dais and seen nobody, not a single person, because when you were up here, there was not a single person behind you. I've never seen that before.
Oh, this is not nobody.
No, I'm just saying when she was up here, there was nobody behind her.
I mean, administrative rules don't get everyone coming out on Thursday afternoon.
Apparently not.
Can't imagine. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, esteemed colleagues on the committee. For the record, my name is Newt Bueller. I'm representative from House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend.
And I am before you to speak with regards to the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 358, which you'll find is dash one in OLIS. And the origin of these amendments is actually from a discussion we had as a committee stimulated by Representative McLean. And if you recall, after we heard some testimony about going back through and looking at for outdated laws, and we did throw out some laws with regards to Y2K, we said, well, what's the process for reviewing administrative rules? So that got me thinking a little bit and doing some research, and I found some interesting legislation, which is actually already in law, and I draw your attention to Section 2 of the amendment, ORS 183.405, which says that not later than after 5 years after adopting a rule, an agency shall review the rule for the following, for the purpose of determining A, whether the rule has intended effect, B, whether the anticipated fiscal impact rule was underestimated or overestimated, C, whether subsequent changes in the law require the rule be repealed or amended, and D, whether there is continued need for the rule. And that's supposed to be done, of course, no later than 5 years after it was passed. The best I can tell, that is rarely, if ever, being done by our agencies, unfortunately. So what this amendment would do would be increase the transparency and accountability to actually just following the law that's already on the books by making the agency actually report to a legislative committee that this is being done 6 months after that 5 year period of time is over. So they have 5 years and basically 6 months, and add some enforcement capability for the legislature. And if the agency doesn't do this, we can recommend to Ways and Means to withhold 10% of their appropriation. And also the governor could withhold 10% of the pay of the administrative head who's responsible for doing this review, released, of course, when it's adequately performed. So that's the summary of the amendments, and this is a big problem. I think we all hear these stories when we're on the campaign trail, and Representative McLean, I know you've heard it, and I hear it, and I'll just give you two examples of what I'm talking about. When I sit on the St. Charles Health System Board of Directors, and a few years ago, we wanted to consolidate CEOs between the hospital that's in Redmond and the hospital that's in Prineville. They're roughly 10 miles apart. Most hospitals now are seeing their inpatient stays decrease. They're just less demanding jobs. We wanted to consolidate those two jobs and have one CEO oversee both of these hospitals. These are small rural hospitals. Well, by administrative rule, every hospital in the state of Oregon must have their own CEO. So we had to go through quite a lot of time, over a year, a lot of lawyer charges, just to get the administrative rule to be changed so that we could have one CEO oversee two hospitals that are within 10 miles. And these are, as you can imagine, highly compensated positions, saves quite a bit of money. One other example from a constituent who is building a retirement care facility in Bend. By, again, administrative rule, these facilities must have hardwired nurse call buttons. Nurse call buttons, good, that's an important thing to have, but the industry standard right now is not to hardwire these call buttons, it's to be wireless, as you can imagine. But again, to go through and change this administrative rule would have taken months at least to change it, delay the project substantially. So what my constituent did was just go ahead and put in the hardwired system, as according to administrative rule, but to use the wireless system like all their other facilities. Again, it hundreds of thousands of dollars of charges. So there's a real compelling need to go through and essentially look through these old, outdated, or laws that just are having unintended consequences. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, and thank you for your diligence. Just to kind of give Representative Buehler a little bit of kudos here, he first proposed this idea to me months ago. I mean, very early on when we had these hearings, and And so he diligently has gone through and looked to try to find a bill with a relating to clause that he could fit this into. And first there was a bill from Representative Clem, but that wasn't going to go anywhere. And so he found the Senate bill, and then he had to go talk to find out, you know, it was a committee bill. So he had to go find out, well, who actually cared. So just a big kudos to you for your diligence on actually seeing this through today. So good work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it actually is your guidance who helped me through this process of finding the right, you know, it's been a good lesson for me to find relating to clauses, finding the right vehicle and learning, you know, the intricacies of gut and stuff of a bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, and not to let Representative Buehler off the hook that easily. So obviously, as I'm looking at this, would it require staff time for agencies to spend? And as we talked about, I mean, there are many, many administrative rules, and I think the intent is great. What I'm curious about is, would this, my gut would be is there would be a fiscal impact to a lot of agencies to perform these things, and that this would need a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And so that's, do you envision that, or what are you thinking?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, this is an interesting question, because this is actually a law that's already passed on the books. It's just not being followed. So I'm unsure if you it require a fiscal impact, because this is something that they're already supposed to be fulfilling and not. So
My only follow-up would be is that if this went to Ways and Means, which would stall out this portion of, basically would stall out the good work on the initial hand that's already passed the Senate, and then because, let's say, there wasn't enough funding to have this go through, that's what my concern would be, is that we would lose portions of the bill that are good because we would then impose a fiscal on the bill.
So. Yeah, I'm not sure we would, because this is something that's already in statute.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting question, because my thoughts kind of follow yours, which is the actual bill that you're proposing is not requiring that they do this. That's already required in law. So it's interesting. That's a very interesting. I'll be curious to know the answer. I guess that's for us to find out when we go to fiscal impact stage, because if it's something they're already required to do, it would be an odd thing to suddenly.
It's not an increased fiscal requirement.
Right. Interesting. Representative Holdy.
Well, I was much along those same lines. I was just curious if the agencies are currently under statute required to prepare a written report and submit it to the legislature. Because that's the new piece of the law that I see that would have the fiscal impact, potentially would be actually requiring the agency to prepare a written report of its findings and submit that report to an interim committee. And, you know, so you are I believe, anyway, that looks like new statutory requirements on the agency that would actually have a cost some money. So don't know how big of a concern that is or what Ways and Means might do with that piece if it costs too much money. I don't know. I mean, I like the concept, I'm just wondering if there's some way to get there without requiring them to do something that they're not already doing.
Yeah, we can certainly work on that with legislative counsel.
And it might be worth looking. So that bill that we passed last session, that I don't know if it required or allowed the executive branch, which is how this whole came up in the first place, to comb through kind of old and obsolete statutes to present them. I don't know if that had a fiscal, because that's just in terms of other bills that have passed recently that are similar in function, that would be one to look at. And I wasn't intimately involved with that bill, so I couldn't tell you if that had a fiscal or not, but it was a similar thing. I mean, obviously there's lots of rules, but there's also lots of statutes.
Right.
And the governor's office actually was asking us for that authority to do that. So it'd be hard for me to imagine they asked us for that authority and then there was a fiscal. But yeah, that would be something that we can work with you on.
Yeah, we'll certainly look into that.
I think there certainly would be a fiscal, because we are requiring people to do additional stuff. The question is whether it's, you know, minimal or larger. That would be kind of the real question for me. And then I guess as a follow-up, and could one of us use a priority bill as opposed to this to move something along, as you know, as opposed to taking this bill, you know, that would be another if it did have a fiscal.
Well, I have a priority bill that you can have if you don't.
Okay.
Because I mean, I really think that the total idea of both pieces of this particular piece of legislation is to really make sure that we have understanding, a control on what is rulemaking and what's not, mm-hmm. what's substantive and what's not, and then also, you know, really looking at some of the other issues that the legal office is looking at. I mean, everything that you're trying to do, or everything that I think this particular Senate bill is trying to do, is to clean up our books and to make sure that we keep them in an order that can be useful, and that we have a reviewer, that there is somebody who reviews the work of both the agency and make sure that it's not policy, but it truly is rulemaking that is effective and efficient. And we heard in parts of it that that's not the job. Sometimes you have to make sure the rules aren't contradicting each other, and that's important, or ordinances and those types of things aren't contradicting each other. But I still think that this cleanup process is worthwhile.
Yeah.
So I think that the committee is making a commitment here that we understand the goal. We think it's an appropriate goal, and that we'll try to see what we can do. But I appreciate your answers.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Representative.
We'll work on those points. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on Senate Bill 358? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 358. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Looks like I'm paying everybody back for the last two times where we've gone over by 10 minutes each. Now we're 20 minutes each, 15 minutes each. So there you go. We're even. All right. With that, I'm going to close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. So cool. Protection and Government Effectiveness.